Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Big Ticket Variety and iHeart's Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Before we get started, I just want to say Happy New Year. I hope you all had a great holiday break. In this episode, I chat with Oscar-nominated screenwriter Anthony McCarten. In the last 3 years, McCarten has written the movies that have led to Oscars for Eddie Redmayne in The Theory of Everything, Gary Oldman in The Darkest Hour, and last year's win for Rami Malek's work as Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody. His latest, The Two Popes, immediately entered the Oscar conversation as soon as it premiered at Telluride. The two-hander is an imagined series of conversations between Pope Benedict, played by Anthony Hopkins, and his successor, Pope Francis, played by Jonathan Pryce. Netflix has campaigned Pryce for lead actor and Hopkins for supporting, and we'll find out if they're officially in the Oscar race when nominations are announced on January 13th. McCarten originally wrote The Two Popes as a play after visiting St. Peter's Square in Vatican City to light a candle for a cousin who had recently passed away. Here on The Big Ticket, McCarten recalls that fateful day. Plus, he reveals why Pope Francis could be a fan of ABBA, and more specifically, their hit song, Dancing Queen. Later on, McCarten talks about his work on the upcoming Neil Diamond Broadway musical and a biopic about the Bee Gees. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. Here's screenwriter Anthony McCarten.
Telluride was, I want to go back next year. Yeah. It was nice for my work. I just get to see all these movies ahead of time.
I know.
So I don't have to run around LA trying to catch up on everything.
Yeah.
I've been telling everyone about Two Popes since I saw it. Go ahead.
I'll put it on
there. Oh, sure. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. We're live already.
We're live already. It's going. I don't waste time. Oh. The movie's fantastic. I saw it the first time in Telluride. Mm. Did not know what to expect. All I knew was Two Popes. I didn't even know if it was about Two Popes. Mm. I was like, I'm going to go. I'm in Telluride.
And could have been two sort of villainous superhero characters called the Popes.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. There's your next Marvel.
The Dark Pope.
Maybe Scorsese will direct the superhero movie of the Popes.
Yeah. The Pope Mobile. We'll have sort of jets out the back, yeah.
And it's just, it's funny. It's, I hate this word, but I'm going to use it anyway. It's educational.
No, educational is good.
Yeah. And it's just, it was really like, I just walked out of it feeling really good.
Yeah.
And it's just, you're watching these two masters just act together.
Yeah, there's a tremendous, I was looking for the word, you know, there's so many adjectives you could apply to their performances. And I've settled on relaxation.
Yeah.
They are so, reached a period of such consummate mastery, both these actors, that there's just complete relaxation in a scene. Mm. And it draws you in so magnetically.
Right.
And I guess that's one of the keys to great acting is relaxation.
Yeah, there's the one shot of them when they're sitting, and I think Anthony Hopkins kind of has his, not his feet up, but you kind of see his shoes that way.
Yeah.
They're just, you know what? Anyway, there's a scene where they're just both of them sitting, and it goes to a wide shot.
Yeah.
And it was just like, okay, these are just two buddies talking.
Yeah, no, the moment's quite a critical one in the drama, because the way it's weighted is that these two characters who occupy different political positions. One's a conservative, one's a liberal. It's a bit like a prize fight. They come in swinging, and then they punch themselves to a standstill, and then they retire to their corners and they sit, and Pope Benedict says to Pope Francis, let's just be silent. Let's just sit with each other and be brothers.
Yeah.
And there's this period of silence in the movie. And that silence is part of the story because it's in that silence. Silence allows for tolerance. It allows for listening to someone. I mean, it's listening. We have a crisis of not listening, I think, to the other side. And that's the beginning of a friendship between the two, of an understanding, of a slow communion between these two.
This started as a play.
It did,
Where did it come from? Where did you say, hey, I'm going to get these two popes together? Because how many people think it's real?
Yeah, well, it's, I'd like to say it's truthful.
Mm-hmm.
We can debate the word reality,
right?
but it's—I don't know. It was—it's either divine inspiration or career desperation. I was in Rome and happened to be in St. Peter's Square for various reasons I won't go into, and Pope Francis was giving an open air mass, and having been raised Catholic in quite an intensely Catholic family, mm-hmm. I knew about that Pope, and I also knew there was another one. There was a second Pope, a shadow Pope, the German Pope who had resigned. And although I was raised Catholic, I didn't know the details of that resignation. It kind of passed me by. Mm-hmm. So I got out my phone and I Googled, when was the last time a Pope resigned? And the number 700 came up, 700 years. It was 1213 when a man called Celestine V decided to resign because he just had enough. Not since then has anyone resigned. In fact, it was so scandalous, this resignation, that Dante, when he wrote his Inferno, had a passage about Celestine V. He called him the great refuser, and he consigned him to the lowest level of hell for the great cowards.
Wow.
And so for 700 years after that, no one would have dared to resign. And I started thinking about this German Pope who was sequestered within the walls of a convent about 100 yards behind the St. Peter's Square where I was watching this charismatic mm-hmm. superstar, Francis, deliver this sermon. And I thought, I want to know what's going on. I'm going to dive into that resignation and see if there's something there. And this play and this movie and an accompanying nonfiction book.
Yes, I just got it, actually.
all emerge from that question.
If you could ask Pope Francis and Pope Benedict something, what would it be?
I'd love to ask them, had they seen the movie, do they want to see the movie? I would desperately love to be a fly on the wall and see their expressions because it's an act of portraiture.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to know if you got it right, you know. I've always ached to know that. I wish Freddie Mercury was able to watch that film.
Right.
The only subject that I've had feedback from, Brian May and Roger Taylor from mm-hmm. Bohemian Rhapsody, they were very pleased with that. It's almost like they come around my side of the canvas and look at what I've done.
Right.
And go, not bad, not bad. But the most touching thing was when Stephen Hawking watched the first screening of The Theory of Everything, and when the lights came up at the end, he had a tear running down his cheek, and he had a two-word verdict on the film that he typed into his little computer, and which came out with that famous computer voice, broadly true.
Broadly true.
It remains the best review I've ever had, partly out of relief, you know, that he recognized himself in there.
Right.
He knew I'd taken some liberties, but he also was sophisticated enough to know that you have to.
Right.
Because history turns out to be quite a lousy filmmaker. So you have to apply some artifice.
What did your family think? You said you were raised very Catholic.
Not all of them have seen it. It's so early in the life of this film mm-hmm. that it's only played in festivals. My sister... who's my oldest sister, who actually was the reason I went to St. Peter's Square that day because she texted me from New Zealand where I was born and said our cousin had passed away and if I was near a church, light a candle. Wow. So I decided to go there and go to St. Peter's Square and light a candle. She's going to come to Argentina with me for the premiere in South America.
Wow.
I'm going to try and make a fuss of her because in her own small way, she's kind of responsible. She is,
yeah. I mean, she lit the fire.
She lit the candle, yeah.
Wow. So when you do a deep dive into something like this, obviously, you know, is there anything that would show or were there any stories about the two of them talking at all? Like, where do you get that dialogue from? Like Stephen Hawking, you had people who were still alive who were telling you stories. I don't imagine you knocked on the Vatican's door and said, anybody want to tell me some stories?
No, they didn't supply me with a giant key or anything. Right. And I got entry to the walled city. No, it was one of the more interesting experiments I've done with the biographical form in a way, in that I did enough research to know what the stated positions and the of each character was, right, and their idiosyncrasies and how they were. But they had delivered these statements and proclamations and so forth,
right,
in separate rooms. So my this is where I got involved and got excited, was that I opened doors and got them into the same room and contrived a conversation, mm, and debate between them along the, you know, the classic rules of dialectic, that argument and counter-argument had to be similarly powerful, mm-hmm, so that it was a fair fight.
Right.
And that was the experiment. And, you know, I think people can get what I'm doing here.
Right.
So although I've contrived the debate, it's truthful.
Right. Where did ABBA come from? Where did Dancing Queen come from?
That was just an idea, a sort of crazy idea I had, to because I wanted to show that Francis was a man of the people.
A whistling Dancing Queen.
Sure, why not?
Going into, sure, the restroom.
Yeah, no, he was a bouncer. He was a bouncer in a tango club. He fell in love with a woman. He knows about popular culture.
Right.
Massive football fan. It's not beyond the realms that
my,
you know,
husband,
for him to,
my husband lost it.
Did he?
He just lost it because he, first of all, knew it right away when he, yeah, was whistling.
Yeah.
And he just, he loved it.
And I wanted this encounter in this bathroom to be Francis whistling Dancing Queen, and for Benedict, the classicist, the dry academic, mm-hmm, to think it was some Gregorian chant and say, you know, what's this tune?
ABBA.
It sounds like a cheap joke, but it's a shortcut to just defining character.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, it shows exactly who they, yeah, are, and then you put them in, at least what I see is you put them in a bathroom where, yeah, sort of that's a very, it sort of breaks down walls because,
yeah,
it's a very intimate place.
Yeah.
When do you know that you've, I know this is probably an impossible question, but like, okay, this is the script, this is the dialogue. When do you know you could hand it over to someone and say, pitch this out there? This
so
is good.
It's, yeah, that's a line that keeps moving, mm-hmm, because there's different levels of completion. Mm-hmm. A first draft is usually a mess, and a second draft is a little better and a little better. So it's when you feel confident, and that's a question of judgment and experience. This is ready to be read. And you kind of learn that along the way. And you have a sense. You have an internal kind of radar about that.
Right.
But there's a great quote that a very great poet once said, that works of art are never finished, only ever abandoned. And so
that sounds so cruel.
Yeah, but it's true. Nothing, perfection is not something that's attainable.
Right.
There is a certain point where you walk away and say, I've done my best at, right, that. I imagine Michelangelo walked away from the Pietà or something.
He abandoned it.
And, or the David.
Right.
And go, yeah, I'm done.
I'm done.
You know, the left butt cheek could have done a little bit more work, but I'm done with this.
Yeah. What was it like seeing Jonathan Pryce and Anthony Hopkins in the vestments for the first time?
Yeah, no, breathtaking.
Yeah.
Breathtaking. We had built the Sistine Chapel for this thing, which
so
is
crazy.
No small achievement. And I remember arriving on set and Anthony Hopkins was doing his first scene in the Sistine Chapel, and I was watching on a monitor, and I watched him, this wonderful performance, as I say, just so relaxed in this medium and so in control. Mm. And loved it. And I went over to the director, Fernando Morales, and said, Fernando, that wonderful stuff. I only have one question. When did you make the decision that Anthony wouldn't attempt a German accent? And Fernando, who's South American, looked at me blankly and said, isn't he? Tony Hopkins swore he was going to be using a German accent. I said, it's Welsh. Fernando, it's Welsh. And he said, oh, my God, I have a dialect coach. And Tony had hoodwinked everybody. He clearly decided that it would be mawkish. To do is a whole German thing. It's a whole, I don't have a sense of humor. You know, all this stuff.
Maybe the two popes in Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he was absolutely right. There may actually be a rule here that we're discovering, that you're allowed one accent in a movie. You can't have two.
No, I thought about it. I actually
like it might drive you crazy.
Right. Well, I thought about that last night. Like I said, it was the second time I saw it, and I was like, there's a one point I think it was Pope Benedict said, like, it's hard talking in English, speaking in English.
It's exhausting.
It's exhausting speaking in English. And I was like, those two guys worked together. Would they speak in English?
Yeah, it would have been their common tongue. Yeah. No, that's not unrealistic that they would use English. It is. It's the franca lingua, isn't it?
Right.
Especially, you know, it's the scientific language, it's the international language of business and so forth. So, no, that's not a stretch.
So Jonathan Pryce looks so much like Pope Francis.
Don't tell him that. I think Jonathan would like to be likened to Brad Pitt. I could tell him that too.
But, you know, in this movie, he happens to look a lot like Pope Francis.
Yeah. It's so much so that when Pope Francis was announced, the internet just filled with pictures of Jonathan Pryce. Because Jonathan was in Game of Thrones at the time.
Right.
A character called the High Sparrow. And suddenly, you know, they were going, oh, my God. And Jonathan's kids ran in and said, Daddy, you're Pope. And it's very cool.
Yeah.
It guided us to Jonathan. What a great choice he was for this.
I saw him in Miss Saigon a gazillion years ago in New York. So it's Anthony Hopkins, it's Jonathan Pryce. When did you find out about the casting? Did you get involved in any, or did you give Fernando, like, hey, I'm thinking about this guy, that guy, or?
The producers and I had talked about, wish lists, which usually is just, you know, something you never achieve. But we went in, and when I pitched this movie to Netflix, we took in two photographs, one of Jonathan Pryce and one of Anthony Hopkins, and we hadn't got them. They weren't, they hadn't committed to it. I'm not even sure they'd even been asked at that point. And at the end of the meeting, when Netflix said, yeah, we'll make this film, they asked, so do you have these actors? And we said, well, not exactly, but, you know, we're hopeful. And we got them both. And I think it was a combination of them both wanting to work with Fernando. Tony Hopkins had already worked with Fernando once and very much enjoyed that. And Jonathan Pryce, it turns out, adores City of God, Fernando's, and thinks it's one of the great films. We got them, and what a wonderful pairing.
And then as soon as it played in Telluride, everyone's talking about it. Oscar nominations. You've been around this block.
Yeah. I didn't really see it coming.
Yeah.
No, I thought this is more one of my obscure ideas, a niche market, a big niche, 1.4 billion Catholics is a pretty big niche.
Do you think, are you nervous about some reaction from Catholics on it?
Increasingly, I'm reassured. I've had all kinds of reactions now pouring in, and they're more than positive. I was with two nuns, and I'm suffering slightly from PTSD trauma over nuns myself, and they came in and I felt like,
whack me with a ruler.
Yeah, whack me with a ruler over my knuckles for being an naughty boy and I'll have to stay after school. And they sat down and they were overjoyed with it. And I think it's partly to do with the fact that it shows in a very realistic way the size of the good intentions working within this institution, that by and large the majority of people working in the Catholic Church and other organized religions are really motivated to do good. And they're working very hard in thankless situations, often unpaid. And yet the overriding story from the newspapers is this continuing horror show of the sexual abuse scandals.
Yeah.
And so that their side, the human side, it is not getting much oxygen. So to see this movie, which humanizes these two church leaders, I think was reassuring. It was encouraging. It was a relief.
But through the movie, there is the thread of the sexual abuse.
There is.
It's brought up a couple of times, and once it's brought up, you can't forget it.
No.
And then at one point when Pope Benedict is giving a saying confession.
Yeah.
it's not like he's whispering.
The volume goes down.
Yes,
and we don't hear what that confession is.
Why is that?
My intention there, and this was an idea I had when I was writing it, because I started to think of what would he, if he begins to confess, when will he end this confession? Because I think that the list of the church's failings is so long.
Mm.
It's such a huge laundry list that it would always feel insufficient, you know.
That's interesting.
So
wow.
I created an empty space into which people could throw their prime
whatever their
thing was, their frustration, their rage, their anger, their disappointment, and it would then become a kind of universal confession.
Well, that's interesting.
So it wasn't cowardice, and I and I'm reassured because it often comes up in questions. You know, you were very specific about Pope Francis's failings and his sins. But you drop the volume on Benedict. You know, is that cowardice? Don't you want to face what that is? It's the opposite. It's the opposite. It's the sheer enormity of the church's failings in the sexual abuse area and others, which I think necessitated that kind of artistic decision.
Right now, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, McCartan talks about writing not only the new Broadway musical about Neil Diamond, but also a biopic about the Bee Gees. Welcome back. Here's more of Anthony McCartan.
So you have a good track record. You help actors get Oscars.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. Theory of Everything.
Someone connecting the screenplay with with an actor's performance is
you're
not
welcome.
The connection everybody makes.
Well, I'm not everybody. Darkest Hour, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
So as Jonathan Pryce or Anthony Hopkins said to you, like,
well
you better.
He damn well better. I whisper into his ear, the volume drops out. And people, what are you whispering to him? You damn well better win. You don't wanna,
no, is there pressure?
A four-peat, that would be something.
Is there pressure?
No, none at all.
No?
No.
It happens.
Yeah, the nice thing about, you know, this is the fourth go round of this awards thing, and the nice thing for me is a bit like Tony Hopkins, I have a relaxation that I didn't have. I was very anxious and quite competitive, and I'm from a very large family and I'm quite a competitive person.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the first go round, I bought into it. I was really wanting to win and stuff. Mm. And it can overwhelm you. It's not good. It doesn't bring out the best side of your nature.
Right.
It's not good for your creativity. It's not good for the reason why we're all here to make good art. Artists shouldn't be put in competition with each other.
You're taking your name out of the competition?
No, I'm just not emotionally investing in it. I'm so pleased with this film, so proud of this film that I'm happy to do it. But I'm talking to myself every morning, you know, there's something unseemly about this artistic competition thing. You've already won. You made your movie, you know, and audiences are responding in an unbelievably cool way.
Yeah.
You know, people falling into your arms, like this happened 2 days ago, and a guy just said, fucking hell. And he had tears streaming down his face.
Wow.
We had about 20 people who you wanted to say to them, don't drive home in this condition.
Right.
Sit down for 20 minutes.
That's art. Who is art.
Who would think that a movie about two old guys in dresses talking about God would?
Well, when you put it that way,
you know what I mean.
Though? Right.
It's winning audience awards, which you usually go to really. You know, a strong element of popcorn in it is necessary to win an audience award. Isn't So we're still trying to work out why it's having the impact, but I think it's got to do with something with that world out there.
What do you think?
There's so much shouting and so much anger and so much polarization that this movie, which really speaks to that, you know, people would start out with very diametrically opposed positions,
right,
reach an accommodation with each other.
But they never agree with each other.
No, it's not necessary to agree with each other, but you can reach a point of synthesis where I take your argument into myself. I live with it.
The compromise is a compromise.
It's an element of compromise. Yeah. Yeah. And it's saying, I don't agree with everything you've said, but there, I can understand why you're saying it.
Mm.
And I can put myself in your shoes, and I will learn something from that activity.
Right.
That will inform my, maybe makes me review my own position. Mm. So I haven't completely adopted yours.
Right.
But I've adjusted mine because I've heard you. And this comes back to something I wanted to mention. You said you're Jewish?
Yep.
Yeah. A gentleman came up to me in New York and after a screening, and he said, you know this is a Jewish movie, and I was delighted by that. I wanted to know why he said it. And he said, because it's a foundational aspect of Judaism to debate scripture.
Yep.
And to look at dogma, not to revere dogma, but to question dogma, to assail it and use the intellect and argument.
Right.
And to engage in a disputation where my argument is meant to provoke an even better counter-argument in you. And it's almost like a game of chess. And it's so healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Catholicism isn't like that. We're supposed to bend on our knee and just receive the word.
Well, I mean, the old saying is, what is it? Ask seven rabbis the same question and you get seven different answers.
Exactly. So it's... he said it was the most Talmudic movie he'd ever seen. And I loved that because it made me think, well, it fulfilled a hope of mine that this isn't just about the Catholic Church.
Right.
It's not even about religion.
No, it's not.
It's about coming to a place where you can tango together.
Okay, a couple of questions, then I'll let you go. Neil Diamond.
Song.
I mean, he's one of my heroes.
But come and join me there. What's the next line?
Oh, I am not doing that.
Come on, what's the next line?
No.
Oh, coward.
Coming to America today.
Today. Yeah. Oh, he's an absolute genius.
So you're writing a musical?
Yeah, for Broadway. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we go into rehearsal in January.
So how'd you get together with this Jew?
Oh, my God, the Jewish Elvis. Yeah, come on. No, I started getting together with Neil Diamond from about, you know, the earliest memories in my childhood. When my mother was blue, she would drop the needle on Neil Diamond, and I know every Neil Diamond song. If you were more game than you are, I'd get you to say a line, and I'd know the next line. So I got a phone call, and someone said, was I interested? I said, am I ever? And so I had the great, great pleasure to meet Neil, and sell myself to him, and he allowed me to begin this journey. So we have a great team. Michael Mayer is directing, and we're hoping to start out of town, maybe like Boston or Chicago or something.
Mm-hmm.
If not in 2020, 2021,
so who's
going to bring it into town?
Who's going to play Neil Diamond?
Oh, we have someone. I'm not sure I can announce it. Yeah. I'm not sure.
I wouldn't tell anybody.
You wouldn't tell anybody. I'm going to leave the town until I have permission. Until I'm certain I shouldn't tell you. But we have a fantastic Tony Award winning actor who's great.
Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah, no, Neil Diamond. I mean, that's my parents grew up in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah. So you're Brooklyn.
My parents grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in Queens. Oh, so they, anytime I meet someone like a Neil Diamond or Barbara Streisand, my mom's like, ask them if they know the Goldstein twins. That's my mother and her sister.
Really?
I'm like, Mom, they don't know the Goldstein twins. Yeah. And then also the Bee Gees.
Bee Gees. Staying alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another phone call.
Another phone call.
Yeah, I was walking in Hyde Park, and the producer of Bohemian Rhapsody, Graham King, rang up and said two words. Well, four words. Steven Spielberg. I went, uh-huh. You have my attention. Bee Gees. Would you be interested? I went, wow. Let me go somewhere where I can sit down. So again, fantastic. Absolutely. Mouth-watering, and to recreate that period, the disco period, will be so much fun.
So much fun.
The music is joyous. Hits across four decades. They reinvented themselves, these brothers, at least three times.
Yeah.
and wrote so many classics for other people, Barbra Streisand, Celine Dion, Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton. Did you know that
Don't even get me started on Dolly Parton.
Listen, did you know Islands in the Stream is written by Barry and
that
Morris?
That kind of sounds familiar to me.
It's the biggest selling country music song of all time.
Yeah. So is someone going to play Dolly in the Bee Gees movie?
They will. They will. They're going to have to do these. Someone's going to have to be Streisand.
Wow.
Who's going to play Streisand?
You know, there's only one person who can play Streisand.
Who's that?
Streisand.
Okay, good. And we're going to end on that quote. Thank you for tuning in.
Listen, the Irishman de-aged in here.
Yeah.
Anthony, thank you so much. This is awesome.
See you, buddy. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That was Anthony McCartan, the Oscar-nominated screenwriter of The Two Popes. The film is available right now on Netflix. That's it for this week's episode of The Big Ticket. Make sure to come back here next week for my sit-down with another Oscar hopeful, Laura Dern. Again, Happy New Year, and if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit me up on Twitter, @MarkMalkin. See you next time.